on stats. Wind northwest at 8. Temperature is 14 in both Racine and Kenosha. Wind chill is minus 11. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's program was supposed to air yesterday, and it's going to feature two different interviews, one with Beth Bush, the guest director of the next production at the Racine Theatre Guild, and in part two, one of our favorite interviews from 2024 with the parents of actor Cameron Boyce, who died several years ago from the effects of epilepsy. They have created the Cameron Boyce Foundation. We'll hear all about it. But here's part one of today's program. For part one of today's program, I am so excited to be reconnecting with Beth Bush. That will be a familiar name for many people in southeastern Wisconsin. Beth Bush and her husband Randy Bush made their home in Racine for many years while Randy was the pastor at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine, where, among other things, he began the Music and More series that is still thriving 30-plus years later. And Beth Bush, very active in a number of different artistic and musical exploits during their time in the Racine area. And then Randy Bush and Beth Bush had the audacity to move away for some years. But now recently, Randy Bush has retired from the ministry, and the two of them have settled in the Milwaukee area. And Randy Bush is now doing some interim work as a pastor. And Beth Bush has found her way back to the Racine Theatre Guild as guest director for their next production, which is a wonderful play by Joe DiPietro called Over the River and Through the Woods. And this is a play that the Theatre Guild did maybe 20 years ago. And I know many of us who saw that production remember it fondly. I very much do. And I'm very excited that this play is returning to the Guild and that Beth Bush is at the helm for this remounting of the play. And Beth Bush, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And I hope you have enjoyed being back at the Racine Theatre Guild. I actually mischaracterized your presence at the Guild. I had not remembered that you had done actually a couple of different things there quite some time ago, of course, so this is actually a homecoming of sorts. Explain what you have done previous to this at the Racine Theatre Guild.
I directed a play called You Ought to Be in Pictures, just a two-person play, and I can't tell you the year.
Long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. I know my so sometime before 2006, and then I was in Honk. Their second time they did Honk, and again it was probably to like 2004, 2005, somewhere in there. You know, because we moved to Pittsburgh in 2006.
Hmm.
Right.
So here you are back, and directing this wonderful play that we're going to get to in just a moment. And I want to mention, too, and I think I've mentioned this to you, Beth, that right around the Christmas holiday, I replayed some morning shows from a long time ago, including a morning show from 2001 or 2002, in which you and a couple other people were talking about a production of A Mall and the Night Visitors by Giancarlo Minotti, his wonderful Christmas opera. And this was the first occasion where I actually got to hear you sing and see you perform after having known you pretty darn well, but that was the first time it actually had heard you and seen you in action on the stage. And it was a absolutely wonderful performance that you delivered, and it was fun to rehear that interview again after all these years. For somebody who does not have direct acquaintance with you and your talents, maybe you could just say a word about where you are from originally and the role that music and theater have played in your life for quite a long time now.
Yeah, I did most of my growing up in Shorewood or Milwaukee area, and I was always from early on. I was in the Milwaukee Children's Chorus, Milwaukee Children's Chorus, and I was always in choir or then productions or plays, and that was definitely true in middle school and all the way through high school and into college. So I've been working professionally as a singer and actress for the last 40-some years in various cities, both Boston and Pittsburgh, definitely when we moved there, and Milwaukee. And I started teaching voice at Point Park University. They have a conservatory of performing arts there in Pittsburgh, and I did that for 15 years while we lived in Pittsburgh. So that was a new area of the business, so to speak. And I did directed a little thing there. It was really more of a little thing that the a community group was putting on about healthcare. So I was pleased to get the call to direct this because I was ready for a new challenge. I've done a lot of performing. I've done a lot of teaching. And I was looking, it was nice to have a new challenge. So.
We should maybe mention that you have a pretty close connection with Doug Instanis, the managing and artistic director of the Racine Theatre Guild. And that is, of course, one reason why he knew exactly where you were and that it made sense perhaps to issue an invitation for you to return to the Theatre Guild. Explain your connection with Doug and his wife, Kim.
I have known Doug Instanis probably since I was about 7 or 8 years old. He and I grew up in the same church, Emmanuel Presbyterian Church on the east side of Milwaukee. And then we were going to the same same high school. He's 2 years older than me. And so when we were in high school, we did a lot of shows together. And then over the years, we just always kept in touch. But when I moved back to Racine after meeting Randy, and I moved back to Racine, and Doug and Kim were attending First Presbyterian Church at the time and knew Randy. And early on when Randy and I are dating, and I was living in Boston, and Doug heard that Randy was in touch with this Beth Johnstone person, and he started giving him his high school yearbooks. So Randy could see pictures of what I looked like, because we were only doing email and phone in the beginning. And so it was no fair.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. So it was wonderful when I came back to Racine, and then Randy and I got married, and here we were, and we had our kids here. Doug and Kim became really fast friends of ours, and we would have anyway, but, you know, I've known Doug since I grew up with Doug. So we go way back. Mm.
So tell us a little bit about the nature of this invitation. Was the invitation very specifically for this particular play for you to direct, or was it a sort of a more open-ended invitation and you gravitated to this specific play as the thing you wanted to direct?
No, it was very specific to this play, and I'm glad it was, because when I read the play, I just thought it was funny and heartfelt and lovely, and a lot of universal themes that anybody can relate to. So it was very specific to this play.
So tell our listeners a little bit about the basic sort of narrative outline of this play, which again is Over the River and Through the Woods by Joe DiPietro.
So it is about two sets of Italian-American grandparents. The play itself doesn't have a specific time, but because of things that happen in the plot, we had to set it in the 1980s. So Italian-American grandparents in Hoboken, New Jersey. Most of the family has moved away, and there is one grandson that is living in Manhattan, and comes every Sunday dutifully, you know, to have dinner with a family dinner on Sunday with the grandparents. And then the grandson gets a promotion. And the promotion, if he takes it, will take him all the way out to Seattle. And then there's the fallout from that and sort of this this generational gap, the older generation not understanding why everybody moves away, because they never did that. That's nothing anybody ever did. And the younger generation feeling like, I need to take this opportunity, but I hate to move away, and which way, what do I choose? And it deals with the question of, you know, what do you owe the people who helped raise you? And Nick, the main character, says in one of his monologues, he says, you know, can you ever repay them? Would it ever be enough? But then I would also add, there's a question of what do they owe the next generation? And whether you stay or leave, the play doesn't wrap it up into, oh, this is the choice you should make, because either way, you're going to miss something. So it's your choice what feels right, but exploring that dilemma. And it's very funny, but also very heartfelt. It's lovely.
That's one of my vivid memories of it. And again, I'm pretty sure the Guild did this 20 plus years ago. I mean, it was a long time ago, but I remember it well. And I remember loving the play, probably in part because this is my favorite kind of play. That is something that fairly poignant, in some ways really substantial in what it presents, and yet done with a wonderfully light touch, with plenty of humor, and particularly with characters that really feel like fleshed out human beings. I mean, not cardboard caricatures. In fact, maybe tell us a little bit more about these grandparents and to what extent playwright Joe DiPietro has really crafted these characters well.
So they're all, and I must say, a plug for the actors. They're all very distinct. I mean, they're all similar in many ways, same generation, same tradition, same sort of outlook on life. But they're all very different. Emma, one of the grandmothers, tends to be a little sassy and is always out there doing things and connecting with people. Ida, one of the grandmothers, is always cooking up a storm. One of the main things she always says whenever she meets somebody is, you look hungry. it's like saying, hi, how are you, to Ida. You look hungry. Let me make you something. Frank is the one who came over as a 14-year-old from Italy, of the three. And so that was obviously a very pivotal moment in his life and sort of colors how he has lived the rest of his life. Nunzio is broad and brassy and funny and out there, but he struggles with some health issues in the play. And they're all distinct. And I think the playwright, to me, has given them each a thing, sort of a through line for each person. You know, Frank, it's everybody goes, why does everybody go? I don't want people to go. Ida is, I want to take care of people. I want to help them. I want to feed you. I want you nearby so I can do that. Nunzio has his own through line. I don't want to give too much away. And Emma is always out there wanting to do things and take you with her and connect you with people out there. So they're very distinct. I'm not sure I'm being really articulate, but they all have their own through line, which I like.
Absolutely. No, I think that's great. Because this is such a real-life sort of story, I mean, this isn't a story of mythological Greek gods or stars of the no. NFL or something that's, you know, just kind of out of our own experience. I mean, this is exactly the kind of story in which so many of us on various levels can relate, either to particular characters or to the dynamics going on in this kind of complicated family tree or whatever it might be. I wonder, in terms of working with your cast and guiding them as they interact with this play and these characters that they are performing, how much did that kind of enter into the proceedings, or does that complicate things too much if you draw on the very specifically personal details of your own life or your own family history? I mean, is that helpful when it comes to a work like this?
It can be. I think it depends on the work. I think it depends on the person. I think it depends on whatever their history is. We know that families come, there's a huge range of how complicated families are. So sometimes, yes, there were people who, certainly older people, I will put myself in that category. By now, we've probably lost people in our lives. So you can relate to that sense of loss. But there was some of the younger cast members had a loss in their family that they could relate to, someone that they could, when they think of their grandmother or their grandfather, they had someone, if they needed to, that they could conjure up and imagine and relate to. I tend to, as an actress, as a director, I tended to maybe use it as a touchstone, maybe a point of initial reference. But then once you start really working and going further into the work, it really, your head really needs to be in the world of the play. But it can be a way to get you into a spot, emotional spot, and then from there, hopefully, it's about the play.
I
think it's a little crazy making to be, you know, I'm talking about Ida, and yet I'm really thinking of my own grandmother. That's a little crazy making.
Mm.
Initially, yes. What did that feel like? What did I feel then? That's what he or she is feeling. Okay, I'm going to go there. But then as time goes by, hopefully it's related to, you know, that my fellow actor and her character in this particular play.
Very well put. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Beth Bush. She is the guest director for the Racine Theatre Guild's production of Joe DiPietro's play Over the River and Through the Woods. I can't remember when I asked you about the nature of the invitation from the Guild. It sounds like you were excited that it was this particular play. Is this a play you had significant experience with?
No, I'd never heard of it before. And he said, this is the title. I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. he sent me the printout of the play. And I read it and loved it and was laughing and then, you know, sometimes crying. My first couple times reading through it. And so I was thrilled. I was really looking forward to putting it on its feet.
Mm.
Yeah, no, that was a happy thing for me.
I think one thing that probably was an interesting situation for you is that I assume you were the primary decision maker when it came to casting this play, and as someone who has not been a part of the Racine Theatre Guild for quite a long time, I am guessing that the vast majority of people who walked through the door were complete strangers to you, and here you are needing to cast a play which has not only roles that in and of themselves are challenging, but also there's the matter of needing to have a cast that's going to work together well, to have believable chemistry, plausibly all part of the same family. Can you just touch on the challenge of being part of the casting process?
You're absolutely right. Most of the people that came through the door, I did not know. I knew one, Phil. I had seen him in Murder on the Orient Express. Randy and I have season tickets, so we had happened to see that. So when he came in, I knew him just from the other play. But the other people I did not know at all, and it was fun to get to know them. It's so funny, you know, after 40 years of what I call being on the other side of the table, you know, being the one coming in to do the auditioning, it's so funny to be on the other side of the table and thinking, okay, what do I need to see? What am I looking for? And then finding that out and watching different people do the same thing. And everybody was good, and it was just a matter of what was the right combination of people that that I had. You know, it really is. Auditioning is such a crazy process anyway, but it really is a puzzle. And it's like the directors and producers, they have a jigsaw puzzle in front of them, and they're missing six pieces. And sometimes the reason why it's this piece versus that piece, it can be something that, I don't know, it's nothing the actors can really control. It's a look, it's a sound, it's a chemistry thing. There were two of the grandparents were reading, and when these two particular ones read a scene, they just had like the right rhythm and the right energy, and they bounced off each other and they looked right. And I said, okay, I've got those two. So it's kind of fun. I mean, it is really fun. And to all those people out there who audition, and of course I've done it for 40 years, it's such a brave, wonderful thing to do. And so even if you go out there and audition, and even if you don't get cast, the fact that you went out there and did that and hopefully enjoyed part of the process, had a little fun, it's such a brave, wonderful thing to do. And I would say just keep doing it because at some point you will be the right piece that somebody needs.
Very good. Yes, I could not agree more. I mean, what I like to say, particularly when younger people are involved, I mean, maybe elementary students and even high schoolers, and for that matter, adults. I mean, everybody's feelings tend to get bruised when they get disappointing news after auditioning. And
sure. One
of the things that is always a nice thing to say, and it's true, is that it's not that you weren't the best. It's that you weren't right. That you didn't quite, your Romeo doesn't quite fit the Juliet or whatever it might be. And I should think, particularly when you are, in a sense, putting a family together, you really have to think about all of that.
Yeah. And for me, it was chemistry and feeling, and do people look right, sound right together? Is there energy right together when you're looking at couples? Of course, it always depends on the script. You know, what does the script require? Anyway, yeah, it was fun.
I want to also ask you about the fact that, as we've already touched on, this is a play that sort of deftly tilts back and forth between poignancy and humor. I mean, it really has. I don't know that I want to say absolutely equal measure, but they're both a really important part of this. I mean, this is not a heavy, sad play with some glimmers of humor, nor a comedy that suddenly has this big tragedy, you know, thrust in the middle of it. I mean, it really blends those two colors together, I think, wonderfully well. What kind of challenge does that pose for you as the director and for your cast performing it in terms of handling those different colors? Or is it written so well that one doesn't even have to be very conscious about that?
Yes. Yes to all of it. It's like it's a big stew. I think it's written well. Like when I was first reading it, I could almost feel the music of it. I could also almost feel the rhythm of it. And I think with comedy, there is always an element. There are different kinds of comedy, but I think there's always an element of technical timing. There's a technical aspect to getting comedy right. It's usually in the timing or the way it's written and how it builds. And so I think one of the trickiest things, and this would be true for any cast, was making sure that where the comedy is, again, you want three-dimensional characters in a certain situation, having the conversation they're having, but knowing it's comic, and at the same time, the lines have to, you know, sometimes they have to build on each other. It has to go bada-bing, bada-boom, bada-bing, bada-boom. Sometimes it has to go fast, 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 pause, laugh line. So, you know, it depends. So the trickiest thing was knowing where are those peaks, you know, here's, and where that pause and to get it just right and then the laugh line. That's always a little tricky because it just is much more technical than drama. the sad stuff, the heartfelt stuff, to me, has a little less timing in it. Yes, timing matters, because no one wants it to get maudlin.
Right.
It needs to be appropriate to the kind of script it is. But there's more leeway in the dramatic parts or the heartfelt parts or the, where people are upset. Whereas a comedy, it's a little more precise. I think it's also written well. And I have some actors. There were many moments where my actors just naturally could do the heartfelt statement and then a breath later say the funnier one in a way that made it funny, but it didn't clash. Mm. It worked. Like they understood the moment. But, you know, life is like that. Haven't you had these moments where some things are really upsetting, then someone, it's graveyard humor, and then someone says something that's funny to sort of either break the mood or get through the mood, or life can be just like that.
Absolutely. It absolutely can. Well, as the person married to the stage manager of this production, I know for a fact from all she's told me that you've been a wonderful, meticulous director, and that this is a very gifted cast giving their all for a great cause, namely a great play. Again, it's Joe DiPietro's Over the River and Through the Woods. It opens this weekend at the Racine Theater Guild and runs for the next 3 weekends. And at the helm, the guest director of this production, Beth Bush. Beth Bush, wonderful to speak with you again. Best wishes to you, cast and crew, for Over the River and Through the Woods.
Thank you so much, and I hope everybody comes out to have a good time.
And you can find more information about this and other Racine Theater Guild productions at their website, racinetheater.org, or by calling the box office at area code 262-633-4218. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And for part two, we're going to rerun one of our most interesting morning show interviews from 2024. This interview actually aired this past November. The month of November is Epilepsy Awareness Month. And for some of us who have a loved one contending with epilepsy, this is something that we know maybe a fair amount about, but there is a large swath of the population that really needs to have a deepened awareness of just how many different kinds of epilepsy there are, the many and different ways in which it can affect people, and the things that we can do to make life better for those contending with epilepsy. My morning show guests today have lived with the reality of epilepsy in a very, very powerful way. Libby and Victor Boyce, their son, Cameron Boyce, a well-known actor, contended with epilepsy. And unfortunately, epilepsy was also the cause of his unexpected death back in the summer of 2019. His parents have created the Cameron Boyce Foundation, which is doing great work in the field of epilepsy in terms of research and treatment and so on. And I'm very glad that we can spend a few minutes talking with them about this and about the new podcast, which their foundation is sponsoring, which is also seeking to make a difference, especially in the lives of young adults contending with epilepsy. Victor and Libby Boyce, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
That was a very thorough introduction. Like,
yes.
You said a lot.
You got it all.
We would say, yeah. Thank you very much for that.
I want to give you a moment to talk about your son, Cameron, even apart from the reality of epilepsy that was a part of his life, and as I indicated, was also apparently a very direct factor in his untimely death. Tell us what you want to say about Cameron and your life with him, and then a word about the role that epilepsy played in his young life and in your life as a family.
Well, first of all, every day we miss him desperately.
Mm-hmm.
Every day we miss him terribly. Obviously, you know, people know him as an actor and all that, but he was our son first. You know, none of that other stuff is important at all. He was my firstborn. He was my only son. And, you know, to lose him at 20 years old was the worst thing, hopefully, that will ever happen to me. It was the worst. However, saying all that, you know, obviously when he was here, he was our joy, along with our daughter. You know, our kids are everything to us. And just like any parent that loses a child, it's just unimaginable. So, you know, when he died unexpectedly, we didn't know what to do because obviously that's not something we had planned on. And then we created the foundation and kind of as a response to, you know, we needed something to do with our grief, which is also a daily thing. So we put our energy into that to help other people because no one should have to go through what we went through. And people are still going to, unfortunately, until we can find a cure or close to a cure for this really frustrating disease called epilepsy.
Hmm. My understanding is that Cameron developed epilepsy rather late. That is, he was a late teen when he first began to show signs that something was amiss. Can you just explain to our listeners what those signs were? What started to, in a sense, go wrong that indicated that there might be a problem, the problem that ultimately was identified as epilepsy?
No, there's no signs there. The sign is when you have a seizure. Cameron showed no sign. He had his first seizure at 16, which was a complete shock. You know, and he didn't have another seizure for almost a year. It was actually a little over a year. And then you're diagnosed as epileptic. But see, epilepsy presents itself in many ways. Some people have seizures daily, constantly, multiple. Some, there's big stretches of time in between. A seizure can be convulsions, or a seizure could be just blanking out, or a seizure could be a twitch. There's different things that happen, and very hard to figure out what type of epilepsy you have, how it's going to present, triggers, and whatnot. Go ahead, Liz.
But Cameron had his first seizure at 16, and it was, he did have the convulsive type. But
right.
The important thing to know is he only ever had 5 seizures in his lifetime, and the 5th one is the one that took his life. Very important message, which is that anybody can get epilepsy at any time in their life.
Right.
So he wasn't really late. He was
right.
Adolescent. But if you were 70, that would be late.
Right.
And it happens. It happens. So some people are born with it, where it can be extremely difficult because, you know, that's when you're developing. And so it does create developmental delays and disabilities. Cameron got it at 16 when he was a little less prone to the developmental disabilities, but it was nonetheless obviously concerning. But he only ever had 5 seizures.
Right.
Yeah,
and
you can get epilepsy at any time in your life. Late is, I don't know what you would call late.
Well, I said
30,
70.
40, 50,
I said
60.
70.
Right. Well, and of course, it in a sense underscores the scope of this tragedy that befell your family. That, I mean, 17, 16, 17, that should not be late in the life of anybody, but that unfortunately was towards the end of the life of your son Cameron. I also want to make sure that we underscore the fact that although the dramatic convulsive seizures that Cameron suffered from are one face of epilepsy, there are also these, as you mentioned, these blanking out seizures. My younger brother Nathan, mm-hmm. who has contended with epilepsy for the last several decades, those are his
mm-hmm. Right.
seizures almost without exception are these petit mal seizures in which he suddenly loses
right.
complete awareness of anything around him. And those kind of seizures are actually easy to miss. It sometimes looks like someone is just lost in thought, and it takes really careful attention to realize that something else is going on here.
Yes, yes, absolutely right.
So in the wake of of Cameron's unfortunate death at the age of 20. I like the turn of phrase you used, that you needed to do something with your grief, and that at least one of those somethings you wanted to do with your grief was to create this foundation. Tell us a bit about the nuts and bolts of putting that together, and what sort of effort that represented in and of itself. I mean, that's the kind of thing that is not created in a day.
No.
Not at all.
It's a steep learning curve.
That's to say the least. I mean, you know, we knew we wanted to do it. We did it very quickly. We did it in the depths of grief. So it really was not easy, but it felt like some kind of, reprieve from the depths of grief. I mean, it just felt like, okay, we can focus on this kind of thing. And you know, we had to get our 501c3, which is our nonprofit status, and we had to, you know, figure out how do we run this? How do we do this? We don't know what we're doing. We happen to have been able to hire somebody who does know what they're doing and has been really helping us, focus our efforts on the things that we care about most, and that there's a gap in out there. You know, in other words, there are a lot of nonprofits working on epilepsy. We don't want to step into something somebody else is already doing. We want to step into something that we can bring value to the table. Mm. So, it it takes every day to run it. But we have a few really good people behind us, and give credit where credit is due. They've kept us, they kept us moving forward, marching forward. And we also have Cameron's best friends, Karen Brar and Sophie Reynolds, who have been 100% the ones behind the podcast, and who are doing a phenomenal job emceeing that. And we couldn't have done it without any of the people behind us in our village.
Hmm. So explain what the focus of the Cameron Boyce Foundation is. And again, I really appreciate your turn of phrase and acknowledging the fact that there are already all kinds of organizations, nonprofit and otherwise, that are working on the vexing issue of epilepsy. What have you decided should be the target of your efforts?
Our target is really about awareness, because Cameron had a lot of fans. We have different eyes on us than other epilepsy foundations and our organizations. So we have millions of Cameron's fans. So, and a lot of those fans are dealing with epilepsy. So our little niche is really in the awareness world, about teaching people like different things that they really need to know about managing their epilepsy. And, you know, also it's very focused on young people, as you mentioned, which is a really critical time for somebody living with epilepsy, because there are a lot of bodily changes, a lot of physical, mental changes in human beings. And if you have epilepsy, you're particularly vulnerable during those times.
Our
focus is young people. Our focus is awareness and really trying to reduce the stigma of epilepsy.
Hmm. One of the undertakings of your foundation is the creation of a podcast. And I listened to one of those episodes earlier this morning. And as a matter of fact, because if I understand correctly, it is really about living with epilepsy, and with at least right off the bat, quite a focus on young adults living with epilepsy. And it made me wish that such a podcast had been around when my brother Nathan was first diagnosed. It would have, I think, made quite a difference for him and for us in those first years.
Right.
Tell us more about this podcast, the hosts, and what you hope will be accomplished with this podcast.
Well, first of all, I like what you just said about wish you had that. You know, that's what we wish, is we had more information or a place to turn, and that's, you know, that's what drives us, and that's part of our mission, is so people don't have to wish for this or that. You know, they can just come to us, or we can direct them to the correct person or a place for information. But to answer your question, Karin and Sophie are the sole innovators for this podcast. They came up with the concept. They came up with even the logos and the way the artwork looks. As far as when you turn it on, they initiated the whole thing, and the whole focus is on young people, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, like where Cameron was and where he would be if he were still here, for those people living with epilepsy, because that is the most challenging time even without epilepsy, when you're just moving out of the house, where you're going away to college, like my wife said, you're having hormonal changes, you're having stressors, you know, you might be experimenting with drugs or alcohol. These things are all triggers for epilepsy, people suffering with epilepsy or living with epilepsy. And it's a very, very difficult thing to manage. Like the last episode they did was about sex and dating, which is something that also can be stressful, you know, especially when you're experiencing epilepsy. So Karin and Sophie have done a fantastic job to launch this and to host this and just to be all in on it. And it's not like they don't do it in a heavy, you know, like woe is me cloud. They do it in an enlightened, you know, we're here, so let's deal with this and let's talk about this and in a positive way. And that's what I really love about it. If you watch it, it's something that's helpful as opposed to like doomsday-ish. It's something to elevate your life and to help you, like my wife says, navigate your diagnosis.
Mm. Yes, and we want to make sure that people understand that this podcast is called Now What? Great title. And it is hosted by two actors who were close friends of Cameron, Karin Brar, yes, and Sophie Reynolds. And they do a terrific job of hosting this podcast. And I am very fussy about podcasts, and I can't stand podcasts that sound kind of messy and thrown together. And this is not that kind of podcast. It is clearly a labor of love and is well worth a listen. For those of you just joining us, I am so pleased to be speaking with Libby and Victor Boyce, and they head up the Cameron Boyce Foundation, created in memory of their beloved son, Cameron Boyce, a very well-known young actor who tragically died in the summer of 2019 due to something called SUDEP, sudden unexpected death in epilepsy patients. And they have created the Cameron Boyce Foundation in his memory to help further greater awareness, especially among young people, about the nature of epilepsy. I would guess that even during the couple of years, several years that your son was dealing with epilepsy, you went on quite a learning curve to learn as much as you could about this. I gather that epilepsy had otherwise not been a part of either of your lives or the life of your family, at least close family tree. And in the wake of his death, I suspect you have learned still more. What would be a couple of the most striking things that you have learned about epilepsy, about sort of the nature of it, and especially what can be done to be helpful to those who are directly contending with it?
I would say, yes, we have learned a lot. I would say, number one, there's sort of a blasé-ness from the medical community. Certainly,
I was going to say that.
From the medical folks that we encountered and what we're hearing from a lot of others. So this is not meant to be a blanket statement, but there does seem to be sort of a little bit of a shrug of the shoulders around epilepsy, and making sure that patients are really armed with all the important information they need. There were so many things left out that we didn't even know to ask about when we saw, you know, our medical team. And it was just like, yeah, just take this, that's it, you know, kind of thing. It was like, no big deal, but it is a big deal. And so that's why we really encourage folks to see an epileptologist, because it's like you don't want to see a garden variety neurologist, especially right out of the gate. You want to see a specialist. You want to see somebody who studies epilepsy, and that's the business. And so, like, those were, you know, some of the mistakes we made. But also, I feel like the medical community really, really failed us. And I don't know that that would bring Cameron back, and I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that to say that we got pretty much zero information is pretty close to the truth. And there's so many things that they need to think about, like, you know, when you take your medicine, it should be taken at the same time every day. And, you know, you can't just stop your medicine because it actually can create more seizures. And you have to be hydrated, and you have, you know, all these things that somebody who is in the medical profession, who's a specialist in epilepsy, will let you know, but maybe not for a more general practitioner. So I think those things are really, really important.
My understanding is that there is a lot of mystery that still surrounds epilepsy for as long as it's been around and for as much study has been done. My understanding is that we still really have very little or very limited understanding of what causes epilepsy. I mean, I think we have probably a very good idea about what's happening in the brain when epilepsy is present and when someone is suffering an epileptic seizure. But what sets all of this in motion in the first place, and ultimately, of course, what can cure it, those remain very vexing challenges. How encouraged are you by the research that is currently underway in terms of these really big questions about epilepsy ultimately being answered?
I think we're encouraged and discouraged. We're encouraged because there is a lot of progress being made, especially around ways to identify when somebody is about to have a seizure, like monitors and different tools like that, that will help us at least, you know, when right before someone's having a seizure and when they're having a seizure, and alerting other people to the fact that somebody's having a seizure. Epilepsy is extremely underreported, like especially epilepsy deaths, because while Cameron died of something called SUDEP, sudden unexpected death in epilepsy patients, you know, people, there are many other epilepsy deaths that do not get coded that way, that do not get coded as a person who died with epilepsy. So unfortunately, we don't get enough research dollars given the epidemic size, you know. And so for that, we're extremely discouraged. But there's a lot of good research going on out there, obviously. There's a lot around genetics, genetic material, and, you know, circadian rhythms and different things that are being looked into that are having some promise. So we're happy about that. But, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't bring our son back. And, you know, our goal is to help others and to push the needle, and that's what we're trying to do.
Mm. Well, we encourage people to seek out the website for the Cameron Boyce Foundation to learn more information. And, of course, also we encourage people to seek out the podcast, which your foundation is sponsoring, which is called Now What, available wherever you hear your podcasts. Libby and Victor Boyce, I thank you for, first of all, taking the time to have this conversation with me. Thank you for the good work that you are doing on this important issue. And thank you so much for sharing freely about your experience, your grief, and your determination to make a difference in the world with the Cameron Boyce Foundation in memory of your son. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an abbreviated version of the program, we're going to be remembering renowned folk singer and songwriter Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary fame by replaying my Morning Show conversation with him, recorded back in 2012. We will be abbreviating tomorrow's Morning Show so we can join National Public Radio in time for their coverage of the state funeral of former President Jimmy Carter. Sunshine is in our forecast for this morning, but clouds rolling in by the afternoon with a high of 25 degrees. Overnight low of 12. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 29 degrees. We right now have a 50% chance of snow on Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.